Many there are who have never heard of the great self within. Many others, though they hear of it, fail to comprehend it. Fortunate is the one who hears of it. Wonderful is the one who speaks of it. But blessed is that one who, having the boon of hearing of it from the lips of an illumined preceptor, is able to realize it here in this very life. Om, peace, peace, peace.
Om Hari Om.
Here in this last class of our Seattle retreat, we meet to summate, bring some sort of closure on this great eternal subject of non-duality or Advaita. It never really finishes. That is, it's an ongoing eternal verity. And the human soul for thousands and thousands of years has been trying to plumb the depths of that, of its own consciousness. And it being so subtle, the eye sees everything, but it can't see itself. And that's the adage they use for that consciousness, which is everywhere and all around us, in everything. As Sri Ram says in this chart, which I explained to you at Satsang last night, but I thought you might want to get one last glimpse of it. And that is that chart where, in exile, Sri Ram, probably in his mid to late teens, is in the forest with Sita and following behind his faithful half-brother Lakshmana, and they are moving through the woods, and they're all trying to stay close to Ram because he's always vaulted into these high, lofty levels of his own thought with a very pure mind. And so in this particular discourse, he said, I will tell you the truth about the Paramatman, the Atman, and the Anatman. Very, very early teaching. Can you think of anyone earlier than Ram? I mean, prior to Krishna, if we were to think. Of course, the system of kalpas and yugas is far beyond history's kin to try and comprehend. And as we were saying before, there's the mythological side of a thing, and then there's the practical side of a thing, and or Vyavaharika and Paramarthika. There's these divisions that are necessarily observable and viewable inside of our world, inside of our mind, inside of relative existence. And we look at them then as best as we can, hopefully with an eye made single, so that we can see the truth. In this case, the ancientness of the teaching forewarns us about the potential philosophical dangers of the mind vibrating around between many different schools and never settling on one, like digging too many shallow wells and never striking water instead of one deep well, and knowing then that not only is there water underneath ground that you can nourish yourself with, but that the water in your well is probably the same as the water in every other well around you, and it's all connected to some deep underground reservoir. And we know also, though, that water can freeze and water can evaporate. So you have those three levels of liquid, solid, and gaseous, which sometimes they use as a metaphor that Ram is using here. And he's choosing to use the ether, that is this unseen, even sometimes rather unknown element. In a general overall categorization, we saw that Lord Kapila pretty much puts it into earth, air, fire, water, and ether. Or if you want to go from gross to subtle, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Ether being the most subtle. So it's a fitting image, and great thinkers long before Einstein, of course, thought about ether and thought, what a great metaphor that is for Brahman. Of all the things that we can comprehend, it's probably the most subtle in our physical universe. And we know that, for instance, great thinkers like Vishishta perfected that idea of the different ethers, that if you transcended the physical ether, then you would be at the pranic ether, pranamaya kosha, or pranakasha, he called it then. And then the pranakasha, subtler than that, would be the manakasha, and then the jnanakasha, and then the chid-akasha. That's a realm of spirit, which isn't really a realm at all, but might as well put it in there, because if you don't, then maybe you'll hear about the Atman and never comprehend it, as we just chanted. There are some who have heard about it, and some who have realized it, but some heard about it and never comprehended it. So this metaphor of ether is like those Chinese dolls that are placed inside of one another, they get subtler and subtler, and you open one and you find another and you find another, till find maybe Chittakasha would be the space that holds them all, if you want to use this analogy. Something even subtler than these various levels of our being, levels of mind, which different systems we've found out have categorized in different way. Now we've had a great input this retreat, this last few days, of some of the Buddhist schools, which are right out of India too, and what they can contribute to our understanding, which is vast. If there's any being in the whole pantheon of India's great beings, the Christians are going to have to look at Lord Buddha most seriously. Krishna, too far gone, too much myth and mystery around his life, although those of us who love him will come right close to him in an instant. But as far as the Christian nations go, Buddha's a contender for the throne of the heart. You cannot deny him, his compassion, his wisdom, and his radical nature, always going forward. You know what I meant by go forward is that story Ramakrishna uses in the Gospel where the woodcutter goes into the woods and cuts his wood for the day and goes back and sells it, makes a comfortable living that way. But one day he's in the woods and a head pops out from behind the tree, and it's a crazy wisdom monk. And he says, "Go forward," and he disappears. So the woodsman cuts a little wood, goes home, and he thinks about that before he falls asleep, and he wakes up thinking about it. So he's in the woods the next day, and he's cutting. And he said, "Well, the man did tell me to go forward. I'll go deeper in the woods this time." And so he goes, and lo and behold, he comes upon a sandalwood stand, very rare. So he cuts a little bit of that, just enough, and he goes home and makes more money than usual. And now he doesn't have to do so much work, and he has more time to meditate, which is, by the way, why you would make more money, why Mother would give you more money. Then the next day he says, well, he did say go forward, so he then goes on and finds a copper mine and a gold mine, finally a diamond mine, as he goes deeper and deeper. So this is symbolic of going deeper and deeper into your consciousness, and this is what Lord Buddha did. Those great swans who find their solitary mountain lake high in the alpine meadows and amongst the mountains, they're not satisfied there very long. They seek higher climbs, rarer climbs, purer water, better views. And that's the divine restlessness of a Vivekananda. He's not happy in the body. He's not happy with the great amount of knowledge he knows. He wants to have it all. He wants to become infinitely wealthy with this treasure of divine consciousness that is his own. He wants to plumb the depths of his own consciousness, which is what Gaudapada has been telling us to do, right? I mean, take that consciousness out and examine it. All the systems seem to be saying that, and in their different ways, but in this particular way, which is more specifically Vedic, and of course you cannot separate Tantra from Veda, where Om is the primal word. The beginning was the word, and it traces everything back to a subtle origin, or a causal origin would be a better way of saying it. Then in that kind of climate, you have to look in terms of these subtle atmospheres that you digest as you go back. As we say, as the particle gets subtler and subtler, the mind develops the quality to digest a subtler and subtler particle. So the kingdoms of heaven that are within you will become revealed to you. So in this way, Ram takes the solid earth and the ether that's supporting it and shooting it through and through and gives us the teaching of Paramatman, Atman, and Anatman. And we know how much of a caucus has grown up around Atman and Anatman in our day and time. But there's also this other very important issue of Paramatman, Atman, because in Vedanta we get that a lot. People say, well, why are you calling it two things? You're talking about oneness and Advaita and all this, and all of a sudden you confuse me by saying Brahman and Atman. Brahman being an equivalent to Paramatman. So very early on, Ram noticed this confusion or potential confusion in the minds of people, and using something that would stretch your awareness, no doubt, but something that was fairly conceivable to most human minds, the ether, and noting its distinction between that and air, which you can displace. So using that very subtle concept, he assigns that symbolically to this Paramatman. It supports everything, but it also shoots it through and through. Brahman is in everything, but it's not the thing itself, it's not the object. You cannot objectify it, so you have to be careful in your assessment of the Mahavakya, just what you're saying, when you're saying all is Brahman, you can't say it from undigested moods that are still knocking around your head, whether they're philosophical or devotional. You have to bring it into some sort of conclusion or siddhanta. So, Vedanta Siddhanta Nirukta Esha, the Vedanta concludes that all this, the world, time, and living beings, jivas, is all Brahman. So I'm going to have to see that by using this analogy that Brahman is in and through everything. As Sri Ramakrishna used to say, like sweetness is in sugarcane juice, shoots it through and through. And that's how he would explain this all-pervasive Brahman. So that's something very distinct. That's the ether that is there, supporting objects and supporting everything that reflects in objects, but it's also permeating them. If you want to go to the Gita, then you hear Krishna saying in the Gita, I have my manifest nature, I have my unmanifested nature, but I have my supremely unmanifested nature too. Same being, next yuga, Treta Dvapara. So you hear Ram teach it in this way in the Adhyatma Ramayana, or the Ramaya Hridayam. And then you hear Krishna say it later in the next age about explaining Prakriti, unmanifested Prakriti, and Purusha, or Supreme Purusha. And Atman and Brahman are conversable terms in the Gita. You hear them both, and they're being bantered back and forth as if there is no difference, because there is no difference. It's just that the Atman is beginning to identify with the sheaths. See, it has that tendency towards the sheaths. For whatever reasons, and there are many why people embody, it goes toward the sheaths. Or as we were saying, that Atman is in the center, in the heart. It's stationary, but it has this tendency to become manifold. And later on, we're assigning that power to Shakti, like the wriggling motion in the snake. It has that power in it. You cannot just classify it as stationary alone, but you can keep that immovable, indivisible, eternal, unchanging, immutable verity sacrosanct by saying, no objects there, no thoughts, no concepts. As long as you do that, then let it play. Like Ram Prasad's song, oh mother, I love to watch you swing. Oh mother, swing, swing. Or say John Lennon, I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll. But I'm no longer riding on the merry-go-round. I just had to let it go. That was just before he passed away. These songs coming to this songwriter's head. So, in whatever field, whatever level, this idea of a supreme Brahman is sacrosanct. We ought to keep it pure and perfect, and an ashram should be the place where you hear about that. To the exclusion, maybe not, of everything else, but definitely emphasized. Like, that's what makes the Brahminical religion, Vedas and Tantras and so forth, so long-lived, is because, unlike most other religions, not only did they just mention God, but they also admitted that it was inconceivable and indescribable. But they did their best to conceive of it and to describe it. And that's why you have the scriptures and their import. Guru Anushasana, the words of the Guru, Vidya Shastra, the revealed scriptures, which Vashishta makes a very big distinction about between fundamentalist scriptures, dualistic scriptures, and so forth, but you have to hear the revealed scriptures, Shruti, first and foremost. And that'll give you this drop of acid, Vivekananda called it, in the center of your being that will eventually burn through everything. Like an almost quoting verbatim, he said, I can liken truth to the most corrosive substance in all the worlds. It'll burn through everything. Solid substance, take a little longer, finer substances immediately. So it's like a river's going to take a long time to make the Grand Canyon, isn't it? But water can penetrate immediately through a Kleenex. So if your mind is more diaphanous, if it's very, very fine, and you hear this truth, you get this non-dual truth, and immediately you've got floods of light entering into your being. And you get swept away by that, and you contemplate it in silence. So supporting all that is this consciousness. And you can come out of that great state of consciousness and you can remember it, like Ram evidently has. Even as a young boy, he's had coaching by Vashishta. And Vashishta has said so many purifying words to him that his mind is just returned to a natural state. And of course, we know in the case of an avatar, nobody's teaching him. He's enacting a play. in front of us. So Vishishta just happens to have the great boon of teaching the most superlative and unique teenager of the age. Yes, that is his student. And he's a master, Vishishta. He can sit just like Ganesha and Vedavasa. He can just roll out the scriptures for you by memory. And all the teachings, he can expand upon them, discourse upon them. Beautiful, beautiful mind. Which you would have to be if you were a mind-born son of Lord Brahma, the father of creation. So Ram, then, is already aware that there's this supreme consciousness, and he's likening it to the ether which holds all things and permeates it. But then he says, then there's the Atman. That is, there's a consciousness that's identifying, or better, associating, because those two words in English make a good distinction. Like my teacher said, you should be able to attach and detach at will. The first teaching you get is detach, detach, because you're obsessed or you're preoccupied with material things and you're forgetting yourself more and more. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, the further I go away from the north, the closer I get to the south. See? So the further away you go, the further you go toward the world, the further away you're getting from Brahman. And that's how people lose themselves in the world. Even though Brahman is still, Paramatman is still right there, waiting for them to come back, as it were. So this Atman is better seen as associating with the sheaths instead of identifying. That's what a Dalai Lama or a Vivekananda or a Ramana Maharshi, and they take a big breath and say, I'm going to choose my parents and project myself down into this world at a certain time in this so-called separated space. All these different akashas rolled out. Like Aurobindo said, the amber stairs of birth and death. I can go up and down the amber stairs of birth and death. These beings can project themselves down then without forgetting their Buddha nature, their Paramatman, Allah, whatever it might be. So when they do this, then they will remember and there'll be great lights. They're still bringing a light of consciousness. They're ones who are associating with the sheaths temporarily. So this is remembering the Atman, which is like the ether, which is then holding things. Not the ether that's permeating everything. It's like intelligence. So Ram is aware of that. He's got his beautiful Shakti. He's got his devoted brother with him. He's got to go back to King Dasaratha's palace and become this great leader for the people. So he's giving out these teachings at a very young age, like Shankara did, 10 or so, when he mastered all this darshan. At 12, he was already teaching graybeard. So an amazing manifestation of wisdom. So there through the forest, he's talking about the Paramatman, like ether shooting everything through and through, the Atman, associating and holding objects, and then finally the Anatman. There's the reflection deer, there's the reflection tree, there's the reflection water, there's the reflection earth. Here's my reflection body. And so down at the bottom then, this quote, and we can move on. Ignorant persons with distorted understanding cast superimposed divisions over the partless, unchanging witness consciousness. Like the sense of agency that is only reflected in the buddhi. Buddhi means your intelligence. These movements and partitions are all assumed by reflected consciousness. The existence of the jiva is also assumed by it. So even the embodiment state is an assumption on the part of the Atman. Jiva and buddhi, that's the embodied soul and your intelligence, are all false separations. Only Brahman is partless and indivisible. Divisibility in Brahman is due only to its adjuncts. That is, its apparent coverings. So this is how he keeps Brahman sacrosanct, pure and indivisible, completely othered. As Sri Ramakrishna said, the only thing that was never defiled by the tongue of man, Brahman. And you're going to have to necessarily transcend the various visheshas, avisheshas, great principles and so forth. And that's where I want to go next, because it's going to help us understand this non-dual philosophy that Gaudapada is proposing if we look at it through one of the most salient systems India has ever produced. This is going to give us some of the dynamics of what Gaudapada is talking about, because nobody becomes realized until they realize the full extent, Paramatman, Atman, and Anatman, all. You have to realize them all as being one indivisible thing. We can always talk about discrimination, neti neti, but we always come to this final conclusion that You can go on denying everything, thing after thing, but you cannot discriminate away the presence of the one who's doing the denying. So there's this one stable principle we're always coming back to. And any contentions would be on what to call it, or how different schools perceive it, or which side of the bread you butter when you go to the breakfast table of philosophy. Here we're having Schopenhauer this morning. Now let's have some Nietzsche. See. Now let's have Kant and Hegel for lunch. See. Hegel burgers. Hunt dogs. So whatever you eat philosophically, it's all the eater, the eating, the act of eating, and so forth, is all done on this very stable foundation. Call it Paramatman in this tradition, or Brahman. So in yoga, he also likes to stay away from most mentions, as the Jews did and as Buddha did, of any kind of assignment of that non-dual, because it's really unassignable. It's unassailable and unassignable, both. That is, we cannot talk it away, no matter how much we philosophize. So it's unassailable as a principle. And it's unassignable means there's just no way that you can pin it down to any particular system, even to any state of consciousness, and probably to any kind of samadhi. However, those beings who have had the highest samadhi, some of them have actually come back, the Ishvara Kotis. Sri Ramakrishna said, there's a few amongst my devotees who are Ishvara Kotis, that is, they're the followers of Ishvara from age to age. They know what Ishvara is going to be doing and when he's coming back. They can go into samadhi, and then they can gather their mind back from samadhi. Most people go into samadhi, game over. Have no hope for me anymore for the world. I'm gone and gone forever, Prasad sings. But these beings can gather their mind back from samadhi. One beautiful thing that you can start with right at breakfast with your kids is just sit them down and have a cup of hot water in front of them and a sugar cube. And then say, okay, now say the blessing, Om Brahmar Panam. Now put the sugar cube in water. And then they put it in and they watch it dissolve. But it's not just, okay, the act is done. No, you have to watch that sugar cube dissolving slowly. Maybe it breaks in half, you see, bifurcation, then it turns into clumps, three or four of them, the different levels of the mind, and then it breaks into granules. And finally, you can't see it. It's completely dissolved, and you have one mass of sweet liquid. Now, that's the teaching of how to take the mind and merge it in Brahman, isn't it? So now we're saying, what about this teaching of the Ishvara Kotis? They're able to bring their mind back from that kind of state and congeal it again. We already know how hard it was for Ramakrishna. He comes out of samadhi, he looks at Swami Vivekananda. What's your name again? I mean, this is his most beloved disciple in the world. He loves this man, and he can't remember his name. And he comes out of samadhi. He hasn't congealed his mind fully back into the brain yet. You see, consciousness, mind, and brain being really three different things. Three different things. Consciousness, the Paramatman, mind, if it's pure enough, Atman, and then the world, the brain, that which has created the world. So how are you going to bring your mind back by degrees? So they give him a glass of water. He'd ask for a glass of water because he couldn't function. And then he'd touch the water and say, oh, yeah, I'm in the land of the five elements. I remember now. And the remembrance of the elements and everything would come back in his mind, and he could remember your name. It's beautiful. I mean, what a great example of going into a sampragyata, through the stages of sampragyata, and then coming back out again, congealing your mind. So we were thinking, how do we depict this for the kids with their glass of dissolved sugar? And we came up with that idea of taking a string and tying it to a pencil and putting the water in a jar and then just hanging the string in the water. Then you have to leave it. It's a great experiment for the kids because they can watch this over days. And you might have done this in science lab, but you can do that in science and draw some certain conclusions on the level of aparavid, lower knowledge. But the paravid, you have to keep your consciousness there, and your directive and your result and your goal is all different, completely different. So you watch over weeks. And so as that happens, basically, it just sucks the water up into the string, and then you see these beautiful crystals being formed. And you can dissolve them again, too, and heat up the water. I mean, let's have a fresh body and see if we can dissolve our consciousness again until we get so good at it, like Ramakrishna said, that you're just dipping your cloth again and again in the ocean of Satchidananda until it becomes soaked and completely malleable under your control. Well, that complete control is what the yogi wants, what Krishna's been talking about in the Gita the last few mornings, and it's there in this process of sampragyata to sampragyata. I've studied this very deeply, as have many of the commentators, and come to some wonderful realizations as a result. And this is a beautiful chart to end with, and so try and stay with this. It is, as you say, an abstruse subject, but nowhere else are you going to find the dynamics of a mind going into this higher seedless samadhi, which is what asampragyata means. And then the sampragyata, the seated samadhis. And it's so beautiful that you could actually see the levels of the mind in their dynamic function. And this is why you had to first study the 24 cosmic principles of Kapila. This is where yoga really borrows so heavily from that. And later, when Shankara gave you the three bodies, gross, subtle, and causal, that was on that one chart we showed on the first day at retreat here, he had divided those 24 cosmic principles of Samkhya into the three bodies of Vedanta. And so now you had two ways of looking at it. One of them philosophical, and the other one sort of personal. Oh, these are my bodies. First I studied the cosmic principles, and they seemed to be something other than me. You know, the rope and the snake was taking place outside of me. But then when I discovered them, looked at them in the sense of the three bodies, all of a sudden Shankara is saying, this is you, this is your Anatman. This is your non-self, but it belongs to you. Your bicycle is not you, but it belongs to you. Your car is not you, but it belongs to you. There's a connection between the two of you. And that's your relationship with nature. Purusha Prakriti, it goes back to this original bifurcation. Call it Shiva and Shakti, or Purusha and Prakriti, or Atman and Anatman, whatever you like. This is all by way of lead-up. You see on the right-hand side of this chart all the lists of the 24 cosmic principles and more from the top down, because the first samadhi that Patanjali thinks you have is a wisdom samadhi. It's a knowledge samadhi. It's the Savitarka samadhi. The way I've described it, just to give you an overview first, is this wash of knowledge that comes over you. You fill yourself with so much knowledge that pretty soon you're going to burst. Well, when you burst, it's when you get that first glimpse of all the kingdoms of heaven are within me. And actually that's the second or third stage in Vedantic steps of knowledge. There are 14 of them, and the first seven are in the world, and the other seven take you out of the world. Higher knowledge and lower knowledge, they call it. Lord Vasishtha's gift again. And he says that basically all knowledge lies within you, is the way they put it back then. And now it's the kingdoms of heaven are within you in the AD age, you know, CE age. So however you say it, if you haven't studied these 24 cosmic principles, then you're really not going to understand what Patanjali is talking about, seeded samadhi. You know, there's seeds in the mind, and then you want to burn them, and then they won't sprout again, and then you're free of bodies. Then you can do what you like. So I've been describing it as this wash of knowledge that comes over you, and then you're just in jata samadhi, is what they call it. You're just stunned for a while, and you sit for a long time. Put you into a stunned state, which I think probably is what Christ was having in the wilderness when the birds were pecking grains out of his hair after a few days. He's sitting under a tree, a snake slithered across his lap, and you see depictions of that, Christ in the wilderness. That was the sort of stunned samadhi out of your mind, like Ram Prasad sings in the songs, "Oh Mother Kali, drive me completely out of my mind." There you are. You've seen it. You've seen it all inside of you in a flash. And this is Savitarka. Let's look at that. First of all, it comes into being by concentration on the gross alambanas. Those are called the 16 visheshas. Final products of nature. Vishesha means the final products of nature. This is like consciousness dumbed down. It's come down into everything, visheshta dvaita kind of idea. And it's just come down, it's become everything. At its very lower, grossest level, it's become the five elements. And the five elements make up the objects. You could say, really, objects are grosser than the elements are, because that's the quintuplication process. And I think it says that here in Patanjali's words, in the mind's move towards unification, it must meditate on the alambanas, the 24 states of matter, until it reaches the seedless samadhi. So Patanjali too isn't calling the avyaktam yourself.
the unmanifest deep sleep, so forth. What Gaudapada is calling deep sleep. He's not calling that yourself either. He's taking it where Krishna called it, the unmanifested. Everything that's potential in nature that hasn't burst into form yet. So you see what I'm saying about Savitarka Samadhi then. Washes over you. It's knowledge samadhi. But when it turns to Savichara, which is the next, and we'll read these down in a minute, now you're meditating not just on the gross avisheshas, which are, remember, the five senses, the five cognitive senses, the five gross elements, and the fourfold mind, that is, antakarana. You're meditating on all these. And when you do, you realize the quintuplication process has happened, and you unquintuplicate it. You unify it, as Patanjali is saying here. You take it apart, and you render it all back into the mind by stages. And that's the antakarana, and that's why it's called the inner cause. You realize all of this has come out of that. Now I know the creative process. Actually, I've just introduced myself to Lord Brahma. Think of it anthropomorphically, or you can think of it as tattvas, whichever way you like. But basically, you've made this introduction to the source of creation, so-called creation, because Gaudapada will come along later and say, you know, a create, as Vivekananda said. So, when you reach Savichara Samadhi, this I've described as you've been inundated by this ocean of knowledge. All of a sudden, you acquire the ability to just focus down on one thing in it. Because it's all so overwhelming. You'll never know it all. And this has been a realization of various seers and so forth. I can never know all that. I better not even assign my name to it. I better not even try and possess any of it. I better not think that I know any of it, or can know it all. That's a realization that any true, sincere, humble seer will come to right away in Savitarka. So there comes this ability, as one sits in this ocean of wisdom over time, to focus on an atom of it. This is where the idea of Adam and the Son of Knowledge comes from. It's all too much. I mean, you can't look at the sun, can you, without going blind. So you're going to have to put on shades, or you're going to have to somehow filter. See, until you can see just one ray of the sun. So that's the idea here. If you sit long enough in this wealth of knowledge that has just burst through Maya, or maybe revealed Maya, then you can develop the capacity to concentrate on one thing, and this is called samyama in yoga. It means you can get the essence of any one thing you want. And you do it by, just like Ramakrishna did the traditions, you put all the rest aside and you focus on this one until you get the essence. Well, this is also inside of you in a microcosmic way. You can concentrate on each little thing. And later on, when you come back into the body, you can use this power of concentration for various things. Like, say, if Madame de Calva comes to you, the famous European soprano, and she sees a poster of Vivekananda on the streets of New York, and she walks into his house, and he completely transforms her life in one visit, and she goes away saying, "That's the most amazing man I ever met," and something like that happens, then you know that some person has reached a certain level of samadhi and they can come out into the world and they can look at you with a samyama eye and they can see who you are and where you're going, where you've come from. It's even in your features. It's a sort of spiritual physiognomy. All these different features, along with how you walk, how you act, how you think. Well, the guru, who's really a guru, is going to know pretty much where you are and where you've been and where you could go. Your potentials too, in a very short time. This is the real guru-shishya relationship, not some pretentious play. This is the real thing. So, this Savichara Samadhi is being able to concentrate on one thing and getting more towards the samyama. And you know what samyama is described as in yoga, right? The combination of the last three limbs. Dharana, dhyana, samadhi. So you can put these three together and get anything you like for any level of existence. Doesn't it sound like Gaudapada's description of Om, the A, you see? That a man who masters A of Om gets anything he wants in the world. The waking state is his. You see how this connects together? So Om then will be the word in which you describe everything. It's going to be for you the source of origins. Because Brahman cannot be a cause for anything. So this takes us through the 16 visheshas and the 6 avisheshas. That is, if you get into the ability to focus on one little essence one atom from the sun of knowledge, then you've discovered the tanmatras. In Raja Yoga Vivekananda says, most of you don't know anything about the tanmatras whatsoever. Only the mystics and yogis know about that. Maybe also the metaphysicians and the clairvoyants are beginning to pick up on what this prana is, but they happen to be obsessed with it. When Vivekananda came here, he said, oh, World's Fair was going on. But basically, he said, as a sort of summation later, he said, well, it seems to me that you're either having seances in living rooms to try and contact the dead, or you're in big tent revivals, he said back in the 1890s. He said, is this your spirituality? He thought we were children. And he said that. He said, oh, you're mere children. You're all wonderful people, and you're generous to a fault. The only fault you have really is that money is your God. Materialism is your God. That's your only problem. You're all generous with your money and all so forth and so on. But where's the higher knowledge? Where's the samadhi? Even the lowest samadhi, where is it? Show it to me. I want to see it in even one of you. This is this idea of lower knowledge and higher knowledge. And when you get to higher knowledge, you can start having samadhis around it. And especially if you know that it's within you, all knowledge lies within you, that's going to be a personal connection that really galvanizes you. It's going to bring consciousness to the fore. And along with it, it'll bring its vehicle, Garuda. It'll bring the pranas. That's the energy which carries thought. And it even carries higher thought. It shoots through the whole thing. I said yesterday, you don't find any mention of prana in the 24 cosmic principles. Later on in the three bodies you do, so Shankara provided for it. But prana can be so subtle, it can be at a gross level where these occultists are very preoccupied with it, thinking that this is the secret of the universe. Sri Ramakrishna used to call that the tricks of prana. The yogis in India, some of them, the hatha yogis and so forth, they're very preoccupied with the tricks of prana. He said, but that's like the occult powers. Why stop there? So at this level, you've uncovered the existence of prana, and you know that it's leaping through the nerves, as Aurobindo says. Light, leaping through the nerves, through every vestige of my being. And it's at different levels. So you can see here audibility, visibility, tangibility, flavor, and odor. That's different than air, earth, fire, water, ether. This is the tamasic side of the mind. Tamasic not meaning slothful and dull, but insentient. So you connect these gross elements with these subtle elements, and all of a sudden you know there's a power in the eye to see, you know there's a power of the ear to hear, power of the tongue to taste. What's this tell you? That there are little gods in me. I mean, this is how to make sense of Indra and his whole pantheon, is that basically you can look at them anthropomorphically, as I was saying, but you can also look at them just the powers of yourself. Kingdom of heaven is within me. So all of a sudden now I have vayu and my sense of touch and so forth, air, feeling. All of this all of a sudden gets connected, and you now have this connection in the tamasic side of the mind. And now you also have gotten it in the rajasic side of your mind. That is these various avisheshas you've just meditated on. And when you put these together, now you have a composite packet for samadhi. You know everything. You know everything there is to know in the relative world. Well, almost. But there is this last vestige of thing to encounter, and that's called sasmita, the samadhi of egotism, subtle ego, refined ego, sakshahamkara, paramahamkara, and also unmanifested prakriti is still to look at, where everything came out of, which might as well be Om. Unmanifested prakriti might as well sort of connect to Om. Maybe very subtle differences there. Anyway, now you've seen Savitarka Samadhi and Savichara Samadhi. Let's read it right down. This is what happens. You concentrate on the gross alambanas, those 19, including Virat and the 16 Visheshas. So that means you look at them on the nature and order of their origin, how they came into being. You look at them around their appearances in time and mind. You look at them on their positive and negative attributes, on their effects on the psyche and your emotions, on the relationship between names, words, sounds, meanings, and objects, all the six levels of Tantra, how you get Brahmagyan in Tantra. Objects, the sense perception, and the mind become more unified at that point, and the hidden nature of the alambanas get revealed. That's what we mean by, I can see the nature of everything now. I see it as it is. So these two points are very important. Objects, the sense perception, and the mind become more unified. Before, you were living a scattered existence. You had no idea of connections. even maybe outward. You haven't even connected yourself with other people yet. So that's an art that's still to be learned. You definitely haven't made the connections inward to your own self. Now these are connected. Now you've set the ground for Salvitarga Samadhi. And very important back here, when you meditate on these, you connect them and you see what they do to your emotions. That would be in the West one of the things that's really important right now. If meditating on fire or water all of a sudden makes me cry, makes me fearful, or puts me in bliss, it must mean something. And you'll never know that until you actually get down to the business of meditating. In other words, I drowned in the last time, or I burned in a house fire. And this is a fear that I have never resolved. I went to my death with it. Now if I'm meditating, samadhi is going to burn that away because I come face to face with it. You don't run away from your problems. You face them off. Face the brutes, as Vivekananda said, and dispatch them. Raise your staff and watch the monkeys that were chasing you just go away. So let's move on to Savichara Samadhi. You're concentrating on the six avisheshas. What happens? Well, first you must concentrate on them in the nature and order of their origin, like before, on their appearance in time and mind, etc., etc. In other words, you follow these same rules for concentrating. Because most people have that problem, and it's very natural. I'm meditating, I'm holding water in my mind. Okay, I'm done. It doesn't go very deep. Oh, water, there's seven oceans in the world. What else can I think of? But no, they're wanting you to take it back to the essence, the beginning of the origins of water. And then you'll understand what liquidity is. That it's a thought. Water has actually come out of your own thought. And this is how you prove that there's no creator God other than your own mind. It starts to get very non-dual. It starts to do away with these misconceptions or half-truths that you've been holding as an individual and as a society for a long time, and it's going to get at this problem. And instead of rather just jumping to some transcendent place, like skipping all the steps from the lowest step to the roof in one big leap, if you're a good broad jumper or high jumper, now you've looked at each one in order and you're connecting them all back inside yourself. To me, this needs to be done for consummate realization. It just needs to be done. And whatever else you might say about the Vedic way, connecting it to Om, and it might be a concept or a platform you're standing on, I prefer that platform because it's going to give me these samadhis. And the father of yoga has told me that. Vedavyasa has told me that. Shankara has told me that. That's good enough for me. That's good enough for me. I'll follow that route, and I'll let you know what happens. Well, that's basically what he did here. So what happens? The mind becomes concentration itself. Nice. The nature of the mind is concentration. If it's scattered, it's not mind. It's not even ordinary mind, because most ordinary minds can concentrate on the TV or on their beer or whatever, on a movie, a video, as you were saying, and concentrate on a video. So mind is concentration itself, and so it becomes that. It becomes what it is when you've put all of these to bed. You've tucked in all the corners on the sheets and the blankets. Now you feel complete. It's no wonder you're starting to get bliss, which comes soon. Now, expansion of the chitta awakens wisdom. He calls this chit-shakti in yoga. First mention of shakti, whew, so glad you said that. I like mother wisdom. I like mother as wisdom. I think that's pretty much one of the keys you put in this big door that unlocks all your innate wisdom. So that's pretty much what he's saying has happened here. Expansion of the chitta. Brahman doesn't expand, but your mind should expand to be like Brahman, which is all expansiveness. We already said it's all pervasiveness, but as intelligence, it's all expansive. It's like the sun knows no darkness. If you're near a sun, all you know is light. And so that's why the Sauryas meditate on the sun. It's the sun god. It's not just a ball in the sky. That would be primeval worship, but you're talking about the light of revelation itself. Hastamalakacharya in the Hastamalaka Stotram has at least five of those 11 verses that are about the sun and about illumination. Then the nature of an object or principle is known. And finally the ego begins to be brought under control.
Well, how does that happen? I think I prefer knowledge to ignorance. That's control of the ego. You make a preference now, you're attracted. Like I say, you begin to get galvanized, and your ego gives up preoccupation with ignoble things, things that are better left where they are, left in mind. Get thee behind me. I haven't been able to concentrate on the important things of my life, what to speak of my spiritual life, so now I'm beginning to see the merit and the efficiency of streamlining my consciousness down to one point, if then I be single. And it's so much more restful, like Ashtavakra Samhita. The yogi in samadhi begins to feel like it's more trouble to open and close the eyes than it is just to be actionless. Too much trouble to open and close my eyes. I'd rather just stay here in non-dual awareness. So that becomes the dawn on the mind, and then you get to Sananda Samadhi. Now, your alambanas there are pretty much boiled down into these two. There's a subtle ahamkara, that is, you meditated on the gross ahamkara before and got beyond the idea of individual oneness. So individual oneness is now beginning to take on the ramifications of indivisible oneness, and that's where the subtle ego starts to fade. And you can see where you're headed towards. Sasmita means with subtle ego, is what he's inferring here. So you must take the individual buddhi to task here, and the subtle ego. And I haven't been reading the quotes here, but step back with me for a moment to the six avisheshas box. Tanmatras are primal matter, the subtle elements out of which the gross elements are formed. Pow. Immediate connection that you never made before. My senses and their objects and the power of the senses have a connection. Earth, the smell, with the idea of smell, odor. So, all right. So then they remain in an undifferentiated state before the quintuplication process takes place at the time of creation. So before your mind fashions all this, they're back there before the quintuplication process, and you want to trace it back there. You want to see everything as it was before it was put together in Maya, is a way of saying. Before it all got congealed, you want to see it. And when you do, you'll know that it's coming out of your own mind. That's a great key. Now all of a sudden you're a seer. You're a jnani, not a agyani. And vijnana is still to come. So how does that happen? You meditate on the subtle ahamkara and the individual buddhi, and the arrow points to that. And the bliss of Sananda must be seen by the nature of its origin, appearance in time and space, effects on the psyche and emotions, etc., etc., just like before with the avisheshas and the visheshas. Now, what happens? The fount of personal joy is located and encountered. Anandamaya Kosha, this bliss, this sattvic bliss. A lot of people, just like the occultists would stop at the pranas, a lot of people stop here, short of higher samadhi. They like the idea of my personal bliss, my sattva. I can stay in balance and everything. I can do this forever. It's very attracting. I used to tell you that when I felt Thomas and Rogers in my mind, pretty soon I would just say, come, sattva, come, I remember you. And it would come, unerringly, every time. An hour or two later, I'd be in sattva. Oh, welcome back, sattva. Welcome, welcome, you shining ones. It's like doing a puja and having an answer from the gods. And it really is very beautiful to be in sattva, but it passes, the gunas pass, they pass, and you have a dark night of the soul, or you meet Mara in its different forms and so forth, so you realize that this is always going to happen like this, and so you hang on to sattva and try and keep it as a balance for a long time. The more you can stay in sattva, the more it'll be a springboard to sasmita and beyond. So let's find out what happens there. In fact, here we could read the quote by Krishna. Having gained that which is considered the greatest gain, and wherein he is not shaken even by the heaviest affliction, let this bliss, which is the disconnection from exposure to all pain, be known by the name of yoga. There is a way beyond pain, beyond suffering. Who said that? I wonder.
The ninth incarnation of
Vishnu. So, let this be known as yoga. All right, so then comes these occult powers as temptations, and the true yogi resists them. We mentioned that in brief in one of the charts yesterday, where Om, as you chant Om, then you realize these powers are coming, and great sounds and visions happen to you, and you say, no, no, I'm going to concentrate on Om. It's a very subtle thing that happens, and then people can get waylaid by these. You'll hear other sounds. Like Holy Mother said, if you hear other sounds at the left side, ignore them. You should concentrate more on the right side of your head to hear that. So it's kind of prophetic because people are talking now about left brain and right brain. So on a psychic, spiritual level, you have these sayings of earlier beings who have gotten specifically into meditation and done these practices. Well, I think I've got a couple years here where I don't have to do anything. I think I'll plumb the depths of my own consciousness. What a novel idea. I think I'll know myself. No, I guess not. Too much trouble. So, occult powers come as temptations. The true yogi resists them. Like Ramakrishna saying, I went to these different realms at the seven centers of my consciousness, and I saw the shining ones, saluted them, and went past them. I also said, come into my realm. Come into my realm. I'll make you very happy. You'll be blissful. You'll have everything. Just come worship me. So, elevator up, he went to the crown chakra, as he said. And his description of that is very beautiful. He said, I was a little boy, and each time I reached the lotus, I put my tongue on it, and it opened right up to the two-petaled and a single-petaled. And then the doorway into the thousand-petaled, as they say, Sahasrara. So he has these descriptions, and he used to describe it like this. Sometimes I felt like it was a line of ants moving up the trunk of a tree. Kundalini felt like that. Other times it felt like a monkey swinging from branch to branch. Other times it felt like a bird flitting from tree to tree. And so he gives these really beautiful, easy to understand descriptions of it, like consciousness is moving in you. It doesn't really move. It's already awakened at all the centers, is how I teach Tantra. You're not awakening it at all. She's already there waiting for you. And the mind is becoming aware of her at these centers. That's real Kundalini coming up the spine, so to speak. So again, you're using the metaphors and you take them non-literally, and you, third and most important, have the experience yourself, so that you connect to these teachings that they've given.
Maybe. It's really practically, yeah. Like you're saying, it's already there. It's just waiting for us to recognize.
Yes. Just like Brahman. It's such a non-dual statement that's so invaluable for us to have. We're almost to the end of this chart. You see why I wanted to bring it out. I mean, more valuable to do this than just to sit and read the Gaudapada Karika and see what comes to our minds, because this really is explaining the dynamics, and that's where we are, folks. You are here. That means on that wheel, you're not at the level of a Buddha yet. You want to be, and that's good, but you should really look into the scriptures and the words of the gurus to get your direct spiritual experience, aparokshanubhuti, which you had a nice term for. You must get that direct spiritual experience. And that's where Ramakrishna concentrates, in the gospel. Sometimes he even seems to put down the books and the scriptures, and your mind can be its own guru. Mm-hmm. But he never discounts the importance of these steps, and neither do these great beings, just because there is a non-dual reality. Well, Krishna admits it too. There are some who love the formless, but their path is going to be very difficult. Now flash ahead to Patanjali, and he says, it's not so crucial that you believe in God to do this yoga, but it helps. So they all know the importance of devotion, and they also know that some people are not born with it. They have to develop it, or it will come to them as they see this magnificent reality within them. They can worship their own self. I mean, the Tantra says that. I bow to the deity of my own self. I worship my own self. At a certain point when all of this inner tendrils come together and all these lines are tied, these loose ends are tied, then it seems to be nothing other but the self to me. Well, here, the last bullet point under Sananda Samadhi, of course, with bliss, this is the with bliss Samadhi, the sense of a separate I begins to reveal its limitations. You want to get beyond even the subtle ego. There's this tendency leaning towards that. Buddha and Christ both must have felt that. A line of demarcation that you want to do away with. I should mention here that now we see that the bliss samadhi is lower than the transcendent of ego samadhi. As you get beyond the sananda and you get to the sasmita, let's see what that involves. Meditation on the linga matra. Well, now you've come to the universal buddhi, mahat, the great mind. This is, of course, very seldom seen. Only rare beings would come to such a level. The equanimity samadhi is very powerful here. You're meditating on mahat, and what happens? He's very specific about it with Vedavyasa's help. Ahamkara dissolves into mahat, the first evolutive prakriti. The very first thing out the gate from unmanifested prakriti is this great mind. You can also assign that to Om if you want, generally speaking. Hiranyagarbha, Pradhana, I mean, they gave it different names in the ancient systems. Then mahat and buddhi perceives, or mahat slash universal buddhi, perceives the presence of prakriti in itself. All of these kingdoms lie within me. My father's mansion has many chambers. Then viveka khyati reveals the separate nature of buddhi and purusha. This is where it gets very subtle and very beautiful. Kaivalya is where you're headed, and it's a penultimate stage in this system. Kaivalya means separation from nature, and you cannot get seedless samadhi until you do that. Kaivalya sometimes has been used as a word equivalent with freedom, but it means isolation. Kaivalya. You must isolate yourself from nature. How are you going to do that? By tracing these visheshas and avisheshas and the subtle ahamkara and the individual buddhi back to the universal mind, and see how all of it has come from universal mind. It's not enough just to connect it to your individual mind, to the collective mind of humanity and the gods and ancestors, and that's collective mind, but also connect it back to the cosmic mind. Like I said yesterday, go up to Lord Brahma and say, I like your bath, but I'm wrinkled, I want to get out. Wrinkled means I'm tired of old age again and again. See, I've been in the bath too long, I got wrinkled. So here's your creation, take it back, I salute you, let me beyond you. So you get my gist here, I hope. You want to get to this place where this very special kind of discrimination at a very high level, viveka khyati, khyati is a kind of a discernment that's very subtle, reveals the separate nature of buddhi and purusha, that is your intellect from the true soul. The true individual soul is what I've been calling purusha lately. There's a supreme soul, but there is this step in between, call it Atman in Ram's chart there, of a true individual soul too. Purusha would be that. I mean, they could assign it that if you look back at Samkhya and you have this insurmountable problem of there only being one soul. Kapila's giving you this idea of the Purusha, but he's also saying that there's many Purushas. So you've got this problem, philosophically speaking, if you're looking for the Advaitic platform. So why not just say this, say that there's, like Ram has been saying since day one, the earliest times, that there is this true individual soul in you. That's who you think you are. Not just the ego who you think you are, but the real you. Will the real you free stand up? It might as well be Ishvara, your relationship with Ishvara, and why you take the mantra and you concentrate on Ishvara and you never do these things. Well, it's very possible that some people have already done this in a previous lifetime, so when they come to a great Swami or teacher, all they need is the mantra to remind them. Beautiful. More power to them. Their fish is cooked. They're ready to be free. But there are so many more souls that haven't even prepared the dish yet to put it in the oven. They don't know what the oven is. That is the fire of knowledge. They have no idea what that is or where to go to get it. So for them, you go back. And if you have any stones left unturned, like the Westerners may have, even though they have the mantra, well, here, you go to your teacher and you look back. Which one of those things don't I understand? Which one of those things can I fill in the gaps of my consciousness with? Maybe that's that one connection that's missing, why I haven't had Savitarka Samadhi yet. Or why wisdom is somehow an unknown quotient to me. Because I haven't made that one connection. So you search. It's inner search. What else do you think spiritual life is all about? At least in the beginning. Sri Ramakrishna said, man sets out to sail in this one-man sailboat. 2 miles off the coast, he hits the worst storm of his life. He takes the sail down, bails water for his life for hours. That's the beginning of spiritual life. Then a few hours later, the storm passes. He trims the sail. He puts the rudder on automatic and takes his pipe out, stuffs it with tobacco, and looks at the stars and sails nicely across the ocean. That's his description of spiritual life. In the beginning, all turmoil and troubles, people give up. But later on, look what's waiting for you if you just struggle hard enough. Struggle to get out of Maya. That's the idea here, only on a very refined level. So Maha disregards all evolutes and reflects only the Purusha. At this time, it's like Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva said, oh, I think I'll turn towards Brahman. That light has been going through me so long, I think maybe I'll abandon my position as Vishnu. Some other great soul can take it up. That's in the Vedas. Indra, Vishnu, Brahma, these are great souls capable of ruling over thousands and thousands of worlds, what to speak of the millions of souls in them. They have had enough. They pass from that position, they hand it on to the next great Vishnu, the next great Brahma, the next great Shiva, and they merge into Brahman. So it's like they turn around and say, oh, I see now where all this is headed, I'm going to merge again. Well, that's sort of what he's talking about here, when Mahat fully dissolves into the unmanifested, called Alinga. And you see that over here. There's the Linga Matra, which is the universal intelligence, and then there's the Alinga, unmanifested nature. What to speak of not knowing the Tanmatras, we have no concept of what unmanifested nature is. This manifested nature is just the tip of the iceberg. I went into the prison the other day, and there's a beautiful picture. I wish I could get a hold of it. Somebody took a camera in the Arctic and went halfway in the water and halfway out with a lens and showed an iceberg. Most of it's underwater, and the tip is on top. So we finally have a great picture of the tip of the iceberg story. And I would just put that on a chart and use it spiritually. See how much we don't know. That's unmanifested property. So much that's there inside of us that we're not aware of, and we're not accounting for it. We can't know it all, yes, but we should account for it. Because then we'll be able to make sense out of these levels of higher samadhi, or the distinction between the witness and the chosen ideal, or the distinction between the witness and the true Atman, Pratyekatman, and the distinction between Pratyekatman and Brahman. There are also subtle distinctions at this very, very high level of experience. Otherwise, there wouldn't be all these many samadhis. And we wouldn't know about them if someone hadn't have done their homework and then followed suit and followed the great ones and had the experiences. So a little bit about that bullet point. This next is that after Mahat dissolves into the unmanifested, the asmita, or the ego, is transcended, and kaivalya, the final break between spirit and matter, occurs. I've already said enough about that, I hope, but it's very important. Separate yourself from nature. Now you're saying, that's the non-self, this is the true self, or that's insentient, this is sentient. Brahman Satya Jagat Mitya is the first thing you learn. Brahman is real, the world's unreal. It's another inscrutable, enigmatic statement that causes you pain. It's the grain of sand in your bed. It's the hair in your ointment. It's the monkey in your wrench. The monkey wrench in the works, in other words. You don't want to believe the world to be unreal. But really, it amounts to the world is constantly changing, and this is what the world consists of. This is what the non-self also consists of. And now you're clear about it. You've cleared up all the doubts, at least philosophically. And if you've done it right, you've meditated on all these, so you've mastered them, because to know a thing is to master it. Then no more fear, no more doubt. Fear and doubt persist way, way deep into the sadhana and theories of lifetimes of an indeterminate person. Many branching are the decisions of the indeterminate, Krishna says in the Gita, but single branched is the determination of the wise. So they've tucked in all the corners of the bed, and they know all of this. Basically, to summate it, is within me. It's all my own mental process. And all the schools of philosophy have come out of that realization. Now, how can I explain this to people? To the people of my time, to fishermen, to gyanis, to bhaktas. How can I explain it? Well, I salute Patanjali. He was an illumined soul. He did some homework that Kapila only suggested at. And now I know the dynamics of samadhi, and I have names for them, and I know that when I go into them, I'll know what's happening to me, and it'll be fuller and richer as a result. Consummate yogi. It's integral yogi. This is what they're talking about. So what happens after you break the soul from nature? You make that final parting. You get divorced because the marriage isn't working. Not at this level. because you come into this world alone, you leave this world alone. So what part of that statement do I need to understand? I need to understand Dharma Mega Samadhi. It's like opening up a door to all of these great, beautiful things, and that's why we have these teachers who are just amazing. We're just amazed by what they have and what they possess. We think it's impossible, but Holy Mother's story is the cowboy. You heard about cowboys, and there was this cowboy who owned a little calf, and it couldn't walk very well, so he carried it to the pasture. He got in a habit of doing this, and he carried it every day to the pasture. One day, some people were standing there near the corral, donning their cowboy hats, and this cowboy walked by with a 200-pound bull. That's impossible. This is us saying, we cannot do what these great beings have done. But they don't think it's very fantastic because they've practiced every day. And when the weight of the world grew, like in the case of the Dalai Lama, he grew with it. He carried it. He was doing it each day. If he had given up his practice, he came back 3 days later and the bull was another foot tall. Oh, I can't lift this, you see. And that's an ordinary soul. In fact, an ordinary soul, what to speak of them, there are these souls that are in very unfortunate conditions. They can't even lift the weight of their own emotions. Or a daily job. Or a little depression. See, they fall apart. They lose their path. They lose their way. At the slightest hint of problem, this realization that came from the fact that when I got Sabhitarka Samadhi, I saw that it was all inside myself. I had a glimpse of that. But my karmas and my samskaras were such that they were a lot heavier. The bowl was too heavy for me to lift. So I gave up. Let it feed itself. And Maya will. It'll feed on everything and take you under with it. So this is this Dharma Mega Samadhi. These beings have this rayed cloud of virtue, and the knowledge of all things transpires. And not only that knowledge, but then they take knowledge and they fashion it into great compassion qualities, great wisdom qualities, transmission qualities, great acts of devotion, great acts of compassion, and so forth. This is called Dharma Mega Samadhi anyway. Then finally, Chit Shakti emerges fully, revealing pure existence, free of all conditions, evolutes, and processes. And then finally, you're ready for a Sampragata Samadhi. About a Sampragata Samadhi, Patanjali and Vedavyasa, like everyone else, won't really go there to describe much. They just infer it. You have to have it to understand it. So he says, this is what you can gather from the sutras. Abides and meditates on the awareness of cessation. Mahanidra. The Mahanidra. Cessation of everything on a great level. Paravairagya has dawned. In control of or void of all vrittis, as the case may be. If you take on a mind-intellect complex, you're in control of it fully. That's why you can choose your parents, you can choose the land you're born in, you can choose the age. The last two things. Now you contain only samskaras of samadhi. And that, there's a whole portion of the sutras given to that. That samskaras in the beginning are what? They're samskaras of the world, aren't they? Lust, anger, greed, envy, jealousy, all those things. But also attachment, relationships, family, society, money. These are all worldly samskaras. So if you try and meditate, and your samskaras call back from that canyon wall, what are they saying to you? Where's my next relationship? You see, how much money do I have? Or why don't I have any money? These are your meditations. This is what you have to look forward to from the mind that's centered in worldly samskaras. But if you do sadhana and you get Sabhitarka Samadhi, now you're changing those worldly samskaras to samskaras of wisdom. And eventually you're changing those samskaras of wisdom to samskaras of subtle ego. Who am I? And then you're changing the samskaras of subtle ego into my chosen ideal. And finally to who am I? I am Atma Brahma. Sounds in English the way it reads in Sanskrit. I am Atma Brahma. I am Atma Brahma. So the samskaras change from worldly to wisdom to bliss to final vestiges of samadhi. So in a Sampragata Samadhi, they describe a sort of cusp where you're going to have to burn these final seeds, nirbija. It's one of the great yogic words, nirbija. There's no seeds of creation in it anymore. You're not going to sprout any more bodies, at least in ignorance. And also, Niralambana, it needs no supports, because the Lambana is a support for meditation, like a candle flame in a windowless plate. You have supports. All objects really should be supports for meditation for you, so that you're going around meditating on everything. Everything you do should be a meditation. And that's how to get into a more refined state of mind. And then finally, it's abhava, it's unconditioned existence. It's your direct experience. And yoga is one of the best facilitators for that. That's why Krishna recommends it to Arjuna. Be thou yogi Arjuna. What more could you ask for or say after that? Just make sure that you're in line with union. To yoke yourself to Brahman, to the highest reality, and think no more of anything but Brahman. See Brahman in everything. So whatever philosophical position you take, whatever path you tread, there is this, for lack of a better expression in English, the great self. So let's chant to that. Om Tatsunayo.
Om Tatsunayo. Rave me mahi. Gatum yagyaya gatum yenu pataye daivi svastrastu naha svastir manuse vyaha urdvam jigatu besajam samno astu dvipade samchatushpate om shanti shanti shanti.
May we offer all unto the great self. May we always delight in this offering. May we always revere the Lord and Mother of all sacrifices. May divine blessings be upon us. May peace be unto the entire human race. May healing, well-being, and prosperity also then abide among us. Om peace, peace, peace. May peace be unto us. May peace be unto all.
Om Hari Om.